Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. The first presidential debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump takes place tonight. Well, technically it's the third. The two men debated each other twice in 2020. They're also the oldest candidates to set foot on the presidential debate stage, a record they also broke in 2020. This is the earliest we've ever had a debate, and it's the first time we're not using the Presidential Commission on Debates. Here to help us understand whether all these historical norms being shattered tonight make the debate more or less important is Political Junkie podcast host Ken Rudin. Welcome back to All Sides, Ken.
Good morning, Anna. Thank you.
So like I said, tonight is historic for many reasons. Millions of Americans will be watching, but the big question is, will the candidates change anyone's minds?
Well, that's actually the true question, because but given the fact that the election is very close and given the fact that there is still a bunch of voters on the margins who say, well, I'm really not sure, or I dislike both candidates, I'd rather vote for third party, a debate like this could make a difference. Now, having said that, we're also making the point, as you made earlier, that this is happening in June. Now, every primary, every debate in the past has begun in September. The one Reagan-Carter debate in 1980 took place late October. So having it in June is interesting, and it may form some opinions that could last until November 5th. But at the same time, given the fact that people don't even remember what happened on January 6th anymore, whether they'll remember this debate not only as late as November 5th or as late as July 1st. We'll see how memorable this becomes.
Most people tuning in tonight will probably be looking for confirmation that they chose the right guy. But there are a large number of Americans who don't like either candidate. They're deciding between voting and maybe staying home. Do you think tonight is about them?
Well, clearly it is. I mean, it's also, I mean, it seems like Trump voters will support Donald Trump no matter what. We saw that even after his conviction on 34 counts in the New York case, his numbers went up among Republicans. His fundraising went up among Republicans. So that's pretty remarkable. And he seems to be invulnerable to bad news. Whereas the Biden supporters, well, I think most polls have shown that a majority of Democrats would have rather seen somebody else at the top of the ticket. You know, when Biden was elected in 2020, nobody thought he would stand for re-election in 2024, when he would have been 82 at the time of his inauguration. And that's, you know, I mean, look, not that Donald Trump is a spring chicken either, but it would have told everybody that Joe Biden may be a one-term president. The fact that he's running again has surprised and disappointed quite a lot of Democrats, and the goal for the Biden campaign is to show, as he did during the State of the Union message, that he's up for the task. Now, the big difference between the State of the Union is that he was reading from a script. Tonight, he will not be reading from a script, and we'll see if that makes a difference.
Politico characterized tonight's debate as a high-stakes hate watch.
Well, these guys don't like each other. I mean, Clearly they don't like each other. And we've seen this before. No, very few presidential candidates are best friends with each other. John McCain showed great respect towards Barack Obama when they ran against each other in 2008. But these guys really don't like each other. And of course, as you point out, this is a revenge match for what happened in 2020. It's the first, as you well remember, it's the first rematch in a presidential race since 1956, when Dwight Eisenhower beat Adlai Stevenson for the second time in a row. But of course, there were no debates back then.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we're all so turned off by this year is we remember how the debate went in 2020.
Oh, my goodness.
The American people. It's about you. That's what we're talking about.
All right. That's the end of the segment. We're moving on.
He didn't take them.
Vice President, no.
Can I be honest? It's a very important question.
Try to be honest.
He stood up.
No, the answer to the question is no.
Ukraine.
No, sir.
With $1 billion, if you
get rid
of
that, you know what? You're not true.
You're
doing it.
You're going to have.
True.
Gentlemen.
So it didn't go well last time they met.
No, it didn't. And there's one. I thought you were going to play the clip where Trump was interrupting incessantly, and Biden was so frustrated, said, "Man, you know, will you shut up?" And of course, some people say, "Oh, that's so rude." But I mean, I think a lot of us were screaming at home, "Will you shut up?" Because he would not stop interrupting. The problem also is, and I checked on the calendar, Joe Biden is 4 years older than he was 4 years ago, and it shows. I mean, I know it's interesting that when you have a 81-year-old and a 78-year-old, it's Biden who's seen as the old guy. But you know something? If you listen to Donald Trump on the campaign trail in the last couple of days, I mean, I don't know if he sounds old, but he could be sounding insane. He's having these bits about water coming out of dishwashers and washing machines, and I'm thinking, this can't be what he's talking about, and it is. Matter of fact, even Fox News broke away from a Trump speech because he was going on about water pressure in dishwashers. So I don't know if Donald Trump will be interrupting. Of course, the rules say that it doesn't sound like he can interrupt because they shut off his mic. But if he does get into this harangue about dishwashers and water pressure and showers and things like that, people will say, my God, which one is crazier?
Speaking of expectations, you know, Trump has made it part of his campaign to call Joe Biden too old, doddering, to portray him as unfit for office because of his age. But in recent days, he's been calling the president a good debater, a formidable opponent. And it's interesting. I sort of wonder if Trump realized that he was setting the bar too low, that as long as Joe Biden showed up, and, you know, didn't collapse on stage, that was going to be a win.
Well, that's why a lot of the new Trump line is that Biden is taking enhancing drugs to make him sound unsenile. I mean, this is...
I will say that's without any evidence. There's no evidence that he's using these drugs.
Well, of course, it's without evidence. And this is what Trump did the same thing in 2016 with Hillary Clinton, that she must be on drugs. She'd probably be taking drugs to, you know, stand up to him for a debate. And that's exactly what he's doing with Joe Biden in advance of this debate, that Joe Biden is on drugs. Ronny Jackson, the congressman from Texas, who used to be Trump's doctor in the White House, is demanding, I mean, like he has the right to be demanding this, that they both take drug tests before the before the debate. It reminds me of Fritz Hollings, the former senator from South Carolina, when his opponent said, I want you to take a drug test. Fritz Hollings said, okay, but only if you take an IQ test. I mean, drug test is crazy. And it's just so funny that when Donald Trump was standing up the other day talking about how cognitive and brilliant he was, he said, just ask my doctor, Ronnie Johnson. He missaid his doctor's name five times. He kept calling him Ronny Johnson when, of course, it's Ronny Jackson. So, I mean, so much for a cognitive test.
The former president, Donald Trump, is also kind of bucking traditional debate prep. He's taking questions, attending events. But President Biden is hunkered down at Camp David with his top aides to prepare. So we'll have to see which strategy pays off. One of the fascinating things is that it's traditionally the incumbent president who does worse in that first debate. The argument being they've had less time to prepare while their opponent has gone through this primary. But Trump didn't debate in the primary.
No, he didn't. But you do make a very good point that the first debate for a president doesn't usually go well. I think of Reagan and Mondale in 1984, when in the first debate, Reagan was just confused. This is President Reagan. This is 4 years after he beat Jimmy Carter. He's facing off Mondale in 1984. And in that first debate, he's confused. He's not on his game. And it wasn't until the second debate with his famous line, I won't, you know, make fun of my opponent's youth and inexperience, that he rebounded. Barack Obama with Mitt Romney, he seemed too intellectual. Like I say, why do I have to show up here? And he was not, I think I wrote that he was mostly a no-bomber in that first debate. But then he got his game back in the second debate. So it is interesting to watch what a president looks like in the first debate. But as you point out also, neither Biden nor Trump have had a debate since 2020, because both candidates sat out the debating during this year's primaries. So we'll see how rusty they are.
Do you think it's a mistake for Biden, given that presidents don't do well in the first debate, to leave so much time between the first and the second?
Well, first of all, I was surprised that Biden demanded the debate. I would have thought that maybe his people say, no, you know, Trump is so unpredictable and so mercurial that maybe you don't have the debate. But I think it makes sense that that Biden does it. First of all, you never know what Trump is going to say. And more importantly, that everything that Biden has been doing and everything that Biden has been showing about his record, he's still trailing in the key battleground states. And he said, well, you know, if my record is not going to, you know, help me win this re-election battle, then maybe the only chance I have is the debate. Because right now, you know, just like President Ford needed debates with Jimmy Carter in 1976 because he was trailing, Biden is considered, even though it's close, Biden is considered trailing in maybe a strong debate, a repeat of the State of the Union, another wild state of mind debate by Trump could help Joe Biden, but it's absolutely a risk.
Donald Trump and his team going into the debate are also laying the foundation that CNN moderators are not going to be fair to him.
Everybody's against me. Everybody's against me. That's Donald Trump. That's exactly what he does. He's saying that Jake Tapper is clearly on their side, that it's going to be 3-1 in the debate. The two moderators, Jake Tapper and Donna Bash, and Joe Biden against little old me. I mean, that's Donald Trump's line. You know, everybody's out to get him. The Justice Department is out to get him. Biden is out to get him. That's what he does, and that's what he lives on. And I don't know if the excuse works right now, but we'll see tonight whether he feels that it's been a fair debate. I mean, I remember one debate where, you know, he kept making noises, like sniffing noises, and he said, well, they rigged the microphones against me. So he is a conspiracy theory of the worst kind. Everybody's out to get him, the ultimate in paranoid candidates. And I kind of think that act should wear thin by now. But again, you know, you're not going to peel away you're not going to peel away Republicans from Donald Trump. The only thing that Joe Biden could do really is peel away those undecided voters, as few as they are. But given the fact that the race is so close, peeling off just even a small percent could make a big difference on November 5th.
Yeah, here's CNN host Casey Hunt abruptly ending her interview with the Trump campaign's national press secretary in setting up this idea that it's just not going to be a fair debate.
It would take someone 5 minutes to Google Jake Tapper, Donald Trump, to see that Jake Tapper has
I'm going to stop this interview if you continue to attack my colleagues. I would like to talk about Joe Biden and Donald Trump, who you work for.
Yes.
If you are here to speak on his behalf, I am willing to have this conversation.
I am stating facts that your colleagues have stated in the past.
Okay.
Now,
I'm sorry, guys. We're going to come back out to the panel. Caroline, thank you very much for your time. You are welcome to come back at any point. She is welcome.
It sounds like they are setting the foundation that if it goes badly, it's because CNN stacked it against him. I'll be interested to see how he takes the question, if he rejects the premise of the question, if he lays that foundation actually in the debate itself.
Well, actually, Casey Hunt and then CNN got blowback from the right wing after that interview. They said, well, this is proof that CNN is out there. They're silencing our campaign spokesperson on your show. And this is just proof that CNN is anti-Trump. But, you know, you can make all the complaints that you want, but it will be interesting to see if Trump is suddenly becoming the statesman or, you know, I mean, we watched him in debates. All you have to do is watch the first debate with Joe Biden last time and to see the interrupting, the impatience, the ultimate shaking of the head. But if he surprises everybody, if somehow somebody convinces him that he should be a statesman and won't say anything crazy, then I think then the Biden campaign will feel that they lost an opportunity, and maybe the debate could help Donald Trump, fend off Joe Biden tonight.
If you want to watch the debate tonight, WOSU Public Media is carrying it. You can watch it on WOSU-TV or at WOSU.org, followed by PBS News Analysis. You can also listen on 89.7 NPR News. And 89.7 here, we're going to have complete coverage tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. Coming up, how the Supreme Court accidentally shared another abortion ruling before it was ready. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And we've been talking about the debate that's happening tonight between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. But in the background of this debate are questions about who Trump is going to announce as his vice presidential pick and whether he's going to have immunity for alleged crimes committed in office. We're still waiting on both of these announcements, Ken.
Well, they are, and it'll be very interesting. I'm surprised that the court, I mean, obviously the court wants to delay the ruling on Trump's immunity in office for actions or crimes taken while he was in office, and they're delaying it as long as possible. I would love to see it happen before tonight's debate, because, you know, if they say that, you know, Trump is completely immune from prosecution, you know, while in office, maybe, you know, Joe Biden could go over and slug him and say, well, look, you know, the Supreme Court said I'm immune.
Oh, my goodness.
It'll be very interesting to see what happens. And that is very crucial. But, you know, something, the Supreme Court is, look, I'm old enough to remember when the Supreme Court was, forget about in 2000, when a lot of people felt that the court was partisan in ruling on Bush v. Gore. But for the most part, the Supreme Court was as bad as Congress could be, as bad as the presidency could be, no matter who's in office. The Supreme Court was something we looked up to as the law of the land. And now we're looking at the actions and by Judge Alito, by Justice Alito, by Justice Thomas, that maybe the court is as partisan and as bad as Congress is. So it's kind of sad what's going on with the Supreme Court, and it's bad that we're losing faith in one of the few institutions that we had respect for, at least until recently.
Also, an interesting twist in the upcoming debate tonight is that the third party candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., will not be on the stage. He is polling at 10% in some states. So do you think, I don't know. I go back and forth on whether he should have been on the stage, whether he shouldn't be on the stage.
Oh, I'll weigh in right now with no hesitation at all. He should not be on the stage. And one of the reasons is that, first of all, the Commission of Presidential Debates always said that you have to have 15% to get on. That's the reason why Ross Perot was on the debate stage in 1992, but John Anderson was not on the debate stage in 1980 because he didn't have 15% of the vote, you know, in end of October. But more importantly, Robert Kennedy is only on the ballot in, I don't know if it's 5, 6, or 7 states, but the point is he's not on the ballot in enough states that it, should he win them all, he'll get 270 electoral votes, which is needed to be elected president. So right now, it is absolutely constitutionally impossible for Robert Kennedy to become president because he's not on the ballot enough. Now, in a second debate on September 10th, if he is on enough ballots, then maybe, you know, his case would be much stronger. But right now, I agree completely that he shouldn't be included.
Do you think Trump or Biden stands to lose the most potential votes from RFK?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. Now, of course, I'm being silly, but I think both have a risk of having him on the ballot. Of course, you know, the Democrats are nervous that the Kennedy name may sway some Democrats to say that, you know, the Kennedy name is better than the old Joe Biden name, and he represents youth and, and inexperienced, as Ronald Reagan would say. But I mean, a lot of his views, Kennedy's views on vaccines and conspiracy theories and things like that, see, and the fact that he was on Fox News for the longest time, he was a Donald Trump, when he was running against Joe Biden for the nomination, Donald Trump loved him, but now that he's running as a third party candidate, Trump doesn't love him as much. But there's some thought that he may take away votes from Donald Trump as well. So who knows? I mean, they're still debating all these years later whether Ross Perot hurt President George Bush Sr. or Bill Clinton when he ran in 1992. I think the jury is out who he would hurt more. But right now, look, I mean, honestly, no third party candidate has ever come close to becoming president. If you think of Ross Perot in 1992, he got 19 million votes. He got 19% of the vote, which is unbelievable. And he got zero electoral votes. He didn't win a single state. So in a race that's so significant, that's so consequential, that could determine abortion rights and reproductive rights and border policies and democracy, it should really be between Biden and Trump. And I feel bad saying that because I've always supported third-party candidates. They have a lot to say. They have views that are not being spread or shared by the presidential candidates. But I think this race is just too consequential, too significant to spend time on a third-party candidate.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the topics that are likely going to come up at the debate tonight, because they're also in the news this week. This week marked the anniversary of the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade. And yesterday, the Supreme Court mistakenly posted an abortion ruling suggesting that they're going to reinstate a lower court ruling that pauses a total abortion ban in Idaho. So, I mean, the Dobbs decision was leaked. This one was accidentally posted. What's going on with the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's sloppy, that's for sure. I mean, when we saw what happened yesterday with the court, it did remind everybody about the Dobbs decision that was also put on the website before it was ready. This is an interesting case because a lot of people saying this is great news for abortion rights, and it probably is, but it's very temporary. Basically,
it's
in
technical.
Idaho, yeah, exactly. Because basically in Idaho, there's a total ban on abortion, and there was some litigation that was going through the state that basically said that doctors cannot treat women who were in dire medical condition for an abortion. And the Supreme Court said, apparently what the Supreme Court is going to rule, if that leak is correct, it's going to say that the doctors can, while this litigation is going through the courts, the doctors can perform abortions for women who otherwise would suffer medically without it. Now, ultimately, they still may ban abortion completely in Idaho, as they have in many other states. We saw, as a matter of fact, in South Carolina's primary on Tuesday, and by the way, there were some fascinating primaries.
Oh, we're going to get to the one in New York.
Oh, good, 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 good. But I mean, all the women who supported abortion rights in South Carolina were defeated. Matter of fact, there's no longer going to be a female senator in South Carolina. But the point is that whenever abortion seems to be on a ballot, especially in conservative states like Ohio, it used to be a swing state. I think it's now fair to say it's a red state. We'll see if Sherrod Brown agrees with that. But anyway, abortion rights seems to win the light of day at the voting booth. So abortion is clearly going to be a big issue tonight, whether the moderators bring it up, whether Joe Biden brings it up, or whether Donald Trump is able to play around with the ruling and the wording of the issue. But right now, it's an issue that the Republicans always used to their advantage in the past. But since Dobbs was thrown out, since the Roe decision was thrown out, abortion rights seems to be a big boost for Democrats when it's on the ballot.
Our producer, Aaron, just let me know that the Supreme Court has formally dismissed the appeal over Idaho's strict abortion ban. So it was essentially, that was the correct ruling that accidentally got posted. So it's officially official now.
Does it mention Erin in the ruling?
It does not, but I am thankful for her update. We are obviously keeping a watch on whether we will see the immunity case come down today.
Oh, my.
It's looking to me like it's going to be tomorrow.
Yeah, it's the big one. You know, I think I heard on, I don't know if it was CBS Radio or NPR, but they mentioned all the cases that the court has to decide on before the end of its term, and they didn't mention the immunity. And I say, oh my goodness! I mean, immunity is one of the reasons why the D.C. Case against Donald Trump has not gone, begun, because the Trump people say, well, wait a second, let's find out about immunity. It's amazing how, other than the trial in New York, that all these cases that Donald Trump has been is under siege for. Delays in the process by the Trump Organization, by Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida. All these things are being delayed, pushed off beyond the election, which is obviously not a coincidence.
Another issue that's definitely going to come up tonight is immigration. President Joe Biden issued executive orders in recent weeks that closed the border to many people seeking asylum and allowed some undocumented spouses and children of American citizens to stay in the country. These executive orders, like President Trump's executive orders, like Barack Obama's executive orders, are probably going to be challenged in court, but they're definitely going to be talking about the border tonight.
Yeah, it feels to me, and I've said this to you before, it always feels to me that the Biden administration responded late to this issue. This was clearly an issue that has upset many Americans, the fact that it seemed to be a porous border, that people were just, you know, streaming across the border illegally. A lot of people were upset, including Republicans, who were making this an issue that Joe Biden believes in soft borders. Now, in fairness, the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate tried to put together a package where the immigration issue would be dealt with . But Donald Trump made it clear that he didn't want any kind of resolution being passed by Congress, so he can blame the Biden administration for it, and he would take care of it when he becomes president. But the fact is that Biden is belatedly come to this decision about closing the border. There was an article in the paper today that it shows that since the border was closed, illegal migration is way down, which is exactly why this executive order was put through. But maybe, I don't know if Biden has taken it, removed it as an issue from the Republicans, but for the longest time, the GOP was saying that Biden was soft on immigration, and it was clearly hurting the president in the polls.
And speaking of things that can potentially hurt people in the polls, I assume we're going to be talking about criminal records tonight. Former President Donald Trump was found guilty on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. They said he did this in an effort to conceal an extramarital affair from voters during the 2016 election. And President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, has been convicted of lying on his paperwork to purchase a firearm. So I imagine both of these issues are going to come up tonight.
Well, in fairness, I don't remember Hunter Biden running for president or anything like that. And when Hunter Biden bought a gun while he was already on drugs, I think Joe Biden was out of office. But the point is, I think that if Donald Trump is going to be calling Joe Biden senile and old and crotchety and all those things, I think you're going to hear a lot of convicted felon coming out of Joe Biden's mouth. And it's not going to be a pretty debate. I mean, I think the one in 2020 was the ugliest in history. I mean, it was just madness, you know, watching the interruptions and Chris Wallace just couldn't get a handle on what was going on. Hopefully by muting the opposition's mics when one candidate is talking, it'll be show some semblance of sanity, but we'll see.
Let's talk about those primaries in Colorado and New York. The two states had congressional primaries this week, and for the very first time, a member of the congressional squad, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, lost. New York Democrat Jamal Bowman lost his primary to a more moderate candidate who was backed by AIPAC with like a lot of money. And it's a bit of a wild story. So what was your take on Bowman's loss?
Well, a lot of money. Let me put it another way. It was the most expensive House primary in history. That's how much money was poured in, mostly on George Latimer's behalf. George Latimer is a moderate Westchester County executive who was not, you know, he's not a showman. He's not a waves his arms and makes a lot of noise. But Jamal Bowman, who was elected in 2020 for the first time, a big victory for the squad. He defeated a longtime Democratic incumbent backed by AOC. I mean, Bowman was backed by AOC. And he seemed to do, you know, it was very popular. It was a very good time for the squad and those kind of, you know, left-wing politics. But what, in the aftermath of the attack by Hamas on October 7th, Jamal Bowman seemed to be saying that, well, he talked about Israeli, I mean, I'm not criticizing him or endorsing what he said, but this is what he said, that he said that Israel was taking it was guilty of genocide in the way it was responding to Hamas, was talking about AIPAC, was being, and he talked about the Jews. Now, that's all fine and well, but this district in New York, the 16th congressional district, is one of the most heavily populated by Jewish voters in the country. And just to, you know, just to be talking about, you know, ripping Israel and the IDF and Israeli actions in Gaza in the aftermath of what happened in the Hamas slaughter didn't go over well. So AIPAC threw in millions of dollars on Latimer's behalf. Jamal Bowman lost overwhelmingly. It was like 58-22. So the squad was on a real rise in 2020 when they were winning all those primaries. AOC had won in 2018. Bowman won in 2020. Cori Bush from Missouri had won as well. Again, these are all squad members, left-wing squad members who support a ceasefire in Israel, and wants U.S. aid to be cut off to Israel if they keep their aggressive response in Gaza. But Cori Bush is in a primary now in August. She could lose. Jamal Bowman lost overwhelmingly. It just seems like we know that how Israel plays in the Democratic Party. And how split it has made the party, as we've seen in demonstrations around the country. But in primaries like this, the pro-Israel, the pro-Biden response seems to have won out overwhelmingly in this district.
In Colorado, where I used to work, GOP Representative Lauren Boebert won her primary. She was going after the seat being vacated by Ken Buck, a congressional district that she doesn't live in, but the seat where she did live turned into a swing seat because of redistricting. So essentially, she looked at her own home district and was like, nah, I don't think I can win there. So she ran in the open primary in the very conservative district, and looks like the gamble paid off.
Absolutely the right move for Lauren Boebert. Absolutely. In 2022, she won in a race that she was supposed to win overwhelmingly. She won by fewer than 500 votes to a Democrat, Adam Frisch. And everybody said, oh, my God, she's definitely going to lose in 2024. So what she did when Ken Buck, as you said, decided to announce his resignation, actually, he's not retiring. He's already resigned from Congress. She said she's going to run in this district in eastern Colorado, which is much more conservative, far fewer Democratic voters living there. She won the primary on Tuesday overwhelmingly, and she will be returned to Congress in November, albeit in a different district, a far more Republican district. Clearly a right decision made by Lauren Boebert if she wanted to stay in Congress.
Yeah, it was an interesting choice. For those who aren't familiar with like Colorado geography, her district, it was over in the mountains, and Ken Buck's district is in the plains as it like goes eastward towards Nebraska. So they're not close. They're a couple hours apart. It wasn't like she was picking up a neighboring district. It was really interesting to watch that race unfold.
And of course, there's nothing wrong with anybody as long as you live in the state.
Yeah, no, it's perfectly legal.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right. And everybody said, somebody wrote on my Facebook page, said, well, what's wrong with Colorado? Well, Colorado has a left-wing liberal governor, Jared Polis. So there are a lot of different politics at play in Colorado. It's considered a purple state. Joe Biden won it, is probably going to win it again. But in certain districts, there are very, very strong pockets of conservative voters that elected Ken Buck.
Oh, Ken Buck's super conservative.
Yeah, and we'll elect Lauren Boebert in November.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see how all of that shakes out. But I think sometimes people forget that Denver is very, very blue, but a lot of the rest of the state is very red. It's just that most of the people live in the Denver metro area. So it's like these blue islands in a sea of red rural spots.
Oh, absolutely. Colorado Springs, I mean, is so, I mean, Colorado has had some very, very conservative senators. Bill Armstrong was one of the leaders of the conservative movement in the Senate when he was in the U.S. Senate. But at the same time, you have the Tom Udall, who was a senator for a long time in Colorado. So there's a big pockets of blue and red in that state, absolutely. Gary Hart, of course. I mean, Gary Hart probably wouldn't get reelected in Colorado today, but Gary Hart served two terms in the Senate when, you know, there was liberal activity in the state. But, you know, states change. I mean, think of Iowa, think of Ohio.
We were a swing state, and we're really not.
Swing state. Obama won it twice. Now Trump has won it twice and probably win it a third time. Wow, it just you know, people say things don't change. They sure do change. And when they do change, they can be pretty drastic. Also, in the primary, I should also mention that in several states, in Colorado, in South Carolina, in Utah, where Mitt Romney is retiring, Donald Trump made endorsements and he lost in all these three contests. In the Utah Senate race, where Romney is retiring, and of course, the other day, Trump said that Romney was the worst senator in history. I love his understanding of history, but he said that Mitt Romney was the worst senator of history. He endorsed a candidate who lost pretty convincingly in the primary. So Donald Trump, I mean, we will see. I mean, we know that he has complete subservience from voters when he's running for president, but that's not always transferable when it comes to state and local primaries, as we saw on Tuesday.
That's Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Coming up, how a deal was finally struck with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking all things national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And this week, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was freed after pleading guilty to a felony charge of violating the U.S. Espionage Act. It ends a decades-long fight over whether to charge him and what to charge him with. I can't believe this has finally come to a close, Ken.
It's a surprise. Some people say, you know, they're glad that it's over. Some people say, well, he's still not, he didn't, aside from his incarceration all these years, or at least his, you know, they held him in custody. But I don't know. I mean, he committed a terrible crime in releasing U.S. secrets and military secrets. And that could have, that may have, it probably did result in the death of many intelligence officials in the U.S. And of course, he fought all this time to be against being sent to the U.S. to stand trial. And somehow they just made a deal. I don't know much about it. I don't know any more than you do, but he made a deal with the U.S. government that he would plead guilty to what he did, and they released him, and he went back home to Australia, which he is, where he is right now. And that's the end of it. He's free to do whatever he wants. He's free to say whatever he wants. And he and his supporters say it's a big victory for freedom of speech and things like that. I don't know. It's just it's bizarre. And it's the kind of thing. It was such a major breach of U.S. intelligence. And now it just seems like it's going to go away. And I don't know what more I can say about it.
This was the leak that Chelsea Manning gave to WikiLeaks that was lots and lots of documents and recordings. A lot of it pertained to how our U.S. military was behaving in Iraq at the time of the war. But there was also, people forget, during the 2016 election, there were leaks from Hillary Clinton's campaign and within the DNC. And Donald Trump even at one point floated the idea of pardoning Julian Assange.
Oh, it wasn't actually leaks from the Clinton campaign. It was leaks about the Clinton campaign.
From the DNC, yeah.
And leaks from the DNC that WikiLeaks released. And, of course, Donald Trump, you know, it's very funny. When those leaks came out in 2016 about Hillary Clinton and that they had the foot on the scale, the hand on the scale, helping Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders and the DNC and things like that, I mean, Donald Trump was having a field day mocking them. But whenever there was a release about Donald Trump, say his tax records or things like that, he was raising bloody hell and said, "How? What about privacy and what about security and things like that?" So obviously, if something is good for Donald Trump, he will laud it and cheer it as he did with Assange and WikiLeaks and everything like that in 2016. When it involves Donald Trump, he's less effusive.
Speaking of pardons, President Joe Biden is pardoning potentially thousands of former U.S. service members convicted of violating the now repealed military ban on consensual gay relationships.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was also a big release of people who I'm thinking of the governor who did it.
Maryland Governor Wes Moore.
Oh, that's right. My own state of Maryland, Westmore, pardoned all those people convicted of possession of marijuana, things like that. I don't know. There are some people who say that change is coming too soon, but there are a lot of people who say that things are changing, that things are changing about sexual mores, about drugs, about, you know, not, you know, recreational drugs that are not as seriously looked at today as they were years ago. And some people feel that this is just, you know, giving these people a blank state and an opportunity to start their lives all over again without this hanging over them.
We've been having that conversation here in Ohio as recreational marijuana begins to go on sale. There's been a lot of conversation in the legislature about pardoning people that only have a marijuana possession on their record.
Yeah, you know, I think back, what was his name? The Supreme Court Justice that I think the first President Bush nominated, Douglas, here I go again, forgetting everything. But I mean, he was a Supreme Court Justice, was about to be nominated for the highest, you know, the highest office in the land. And he had to withdraw his nomination, prospective nomination, because he admitted smoking pot in college. And then Bill Clinton gave that crazy.
I did not inhale.
Yeah, I did not inhale. You know, it's just, I mean, it seems like it's a million years ago, but it was not that long ago. Look, I always say that also in 2008, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, all the Democrats said that marriage should be between a man and a woman. 2008 wasn't that long ago. So things do change. Some people think it takes too long, but things do change. And I think attitudes do change. And this is certainly one case of that.
And I want to remind listeners that you can watch tonight's presidential debate right here on WOSU Public Media. You can watch it on WOSU TV or WOSU.org, and you can also listen to it right here on 89.7 NPR News. You know, we're going to see a lot of people running spin.
Let me interrupt for a second.
Oh, sure.
Your producer, Marcus Charleston, always bails me out when I can't remember. Douglas Ginsburg was the Supreme Court prospective nominee who withdrew because he smoked pot. Thanks, Douglas.
No.
I mean, thanks, Mark.
the producers do the Lord's work here at all sides. That's right. They That's are true. Very appreciated.
I mean, Aaron was mentioned by the Supreme Court. Isn't that what you told me? No, you didn't tell me that.
Yeah. So, you know, we're going to see a lot of folks out running spin for both President Trump and Biden tonight after the debate, talking about who won, who lost. I want to briefly touch on J.D. Vance. We're probably going to see him. And as early as this week or next week, we could see him as the vice presidential nominee, which is kind of wild to me. It's a very rocket to the top story for him.
Oh, it's unbelievable, considering the fact in 2016 he was an anti-Trumper. I mean, he was saying that Trump is Hitler. I think he really equated Trump with Hitler back in 2016, and now he's his biggest booster. He's actually my prediction for vice president.
Mine too. I have this gut feeling it's going to be him.
But here's the thing. Donald Trump really doesn't like anybody to upstage him and to outshine him. And J.D. Vance is that kind of candidate who can, you know, certainly they look at him and say, well, he's not the crazy Donald Trump, even though, you know, if you're talking about ideology, I mean, J.D. Vance is as an extreme conservative as you can get. But he says it with a smile. There was an interview, a sit-down interview with his wife, and his wife looked very impressive as well. So,
I saw part of that. They talked about their faith because she's Hindu and he's Christian, and it was a really interesting interview.
Absolutely fascinating. As a matter of fact, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times said, "Wow, this was really great." She said this on social media, and everybody yelled at her and said, "Wait, you're praising J.D. Vance? What are you crazy?" And so, as everything is on social media, Maggie Haberman got clobbered. But knowing Donald Trump, I mean, Doug Burgum, who's the colorless governor of North Dakota, that's the kind of thing that would make sense for Donald Trump. He wouldn't upstage him. He's kind of colorless, boring, and he wouldn't be the future of the Republican Party. And of course, Donald Trump doesn't want anybody to be the present or the future of the Republican Party if his name isn't Donald Trump. So Doug Burgum makes the most sense. I mean, Doug Burgum sounds like a Trump choice, but if I were a Republican strategist and I were thinking about the future of the Republican Party, J.D. Vance makes the most sense. You notice that J.D. Vance, Doug Burgum, and Marco Rubio have all been invited by Trump to come to Atlanta for the debate today. And just like a lot of them showed up at the court in New York, Trump needs everybody to, you know, just show subservience to him. And of course, if you want to be vice president, as Mike Pence learned, you need to be subservient at the same time.
Axios is actually reporting something that I thought was really fascinating, was Vance said he would be disappointed if he wasn't chosen as Trump's VP pick. And I thought that was unusual that he actually came out and said, you know, I'm going to be a little sad if I don't get it.
Well, you know something, that was, I read that too, and I thought that was honest. You know,
yeah.
a lot of people say like,
oh, it's an honor to be nominated or considered.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I remember John Edwards, before John Kerry picked him, he said, oh, no, I have no interest in all of being vice president. And then, of course, when John Kerry's call came in, John Edwards said, that's great. And of course, we also remember in 2000 when Dick Cheney was leading the search committee for a running mate and
himself.
Said, I'll pick him. And so, you know, I'd love to have it. We should have a show on the history of vice presidential choices, the ones that made sense, the one that didn't.
Oh, my God, I would love to do this. We have
Farrell
to do
Agnew,
it.
I mean, Sarah Palin, Tom Eagleton.
Oh, there's, you know, so many. Dan Quayle. Like, there's so many.
But you know something here? Let me, one last thought about a debate. And everybody talks about the 1988 vice presidential debate between Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle. And Lloyd Benson said, well, you're no Jack Kennedy. And everybody, and Dan Quayle looked like he was the deer in the headlights. And everybody would say, whooped and hollered, and how stupid they said that Dan Quayle looked. And meanwhile, the Bush-Quayle team won 40 out of 50 states. So you can talk about a debate. You can talk about how significant it was. And as you mentioned, watch those spinners tonight and tomorrow morning saying, you know, what really happened. But ultimately, it may not matter. I mean, I can't imagine a vice president making a big difference for Donald Trump, because we know who Donald Trump is. It may make a difference in, like, you know, for example, J.D. Vance versus Kamala Harris debate. But the point is, debates usually don't matter significantly, but we do love them when they're happening.
That was Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.